together. Section, we're going to add the text into the first section, and then we'll learn the second section as a niggun and a text.
Hi-ya, hi-ya, hi-ya. But now we're going to unpack it a little bit with some texts about Hannah's tefillah. So this one I know you saw this morning. So let's read it aloud together. And as we're reading it, I want us to think about Hannah is a really expressive prayer. What is it that makes her tefillah so expressive?
Being bitter of spirit, she prayed at the Lord, weeping all the while. As she kept on praying before the Lord, Eli washed her mouth. Now Hannah was praying in her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice could not be heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Eli said to her, "How long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Sober up. Remove your wine from upon you." And Hannah replied, "Oh no, my Lord. I am a very unhappy woman. I have drunk no wine or other strong drink, but I have been pouring out my heart before the Lord."
So what is it that makes Hannah's prayer something that we turn back to? Or what is it that makes it in this text? How does the Torah, or the Tanakh, paint her as being so expressive?
I love this line of the kolah lo yishamea. It feels like a very sneaky use of the passive voice. That it's Eli lo shomea as kolah, and it's almost like he's jealous of her relationship with God. He's upset to not be included in this moment. Mm-hmm. But it also speaks a lot about what her prayer is.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's like the fact that her voice isn't heard is kind of part of the expressiveness, mm-hmm. right? Because I think what you're pointing to is like, it's that silence that is almost like triggering for him. Yeah.
I think something else I'm seeing is she's like reverse drunk. She says, "I've been pouring out my heart before the Lord." She's not drinking anything, but she's giving so much that a person might see that the power passed through and think of her as drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things also like with the weeping and the like literal language is like, "I'm a very unhappy woman. I'm pouring out my heart." There's a vulnerability to admitting a place of deep sadness instead of the gratitude that we usually see approach to God with prayer. Mm-hmm. There's generally a tendency, even, you know, the Morning's Kaddish is a prayer of gratitude.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of space usually for grief, at least explicitly in the words of prayer.
So the rabbis see Hannah as a model for tefillah. And one of the things we find really fascinating about that is that quiet. And I think that something that quiet invites is multiple interpretations of what it means for her to be a model, right? Because she's sort of there in this kind of expressive acting, but not no speech kind of being heard. I think that's one of the things that sort of like has sort of captures the rabbinic imagination and sort of puts her there as a model for us. And so what we're going to be doing together, I'll say something if you want to add, feel free, is we're going to be continuing to sing this nigun. And as we do, we're going to be exploring different ways of singing this nigun, different emotions that this nigun might be able to hold, just like Hannah's expressive silence could hold so many different interpretation.
As we start singing it again right now, you'll notice I'm going to start sort of moving us for a little bit into different sort of musical postures of this nigun. Louder, softer, bigger, smaller, different spaces. So try to flow with us, and then afterwards try to notice What different directions did the Nigun go in? And then we're going to dig in a little bit deeper into how that might get manifested in different interpretations of this particular text. So let's sing it some more together, and let's try to move through these different ways of being in this song. So I think before we go on, I'd just like to kind of unpack a little. What are some different spaces we went into just now? What are some different postures or embodiments within the context of this niggun that we found ourselves? What did we notice? What did we do?
One that stuck with me was about 2/5 of the way, and we switched to this very driving setting. It was the one where I accidentally tried to sing it in double time. It was so intense.
Oh, okay. So we were driving enough that your instinct was actually to speed up the whole niggun. But in reality, we were going slower. We were adding a pulse, which actually forced us to take a little bit more time with the song. There's something about the drive that allowed us to slow down into the text.
There's something really cool about going back to the wordless after doing the words. I'm not sure what it is. I don't have like anything right now. Any like words to that, but I love in a lot of different settings, especially now. Like the words are sort of ringing, but they're not.
Yeah, so vacillating between words and wordless, and maybe noticing how our own orientation to the act of the song changes when we have the anchoring of the words versus the like unmooring of the niggun. Yeah.
What you were saying also made me think about Hana and like Kalala Ishama, right? That there's like, it's not, you know, it's possible she was actually crying out loud, right? But like her words were not heard, and it's interesting to like go from the experience of like the wordless, then to the worded, and then to the wordless again. And like, it's maybe what you were saying, right? With like, with the reverberations of the words still, but they're not what you're actually saying.
Yeah. Right, in some ways, can the lack of words, but the act of singing express the act of prayer that no one else can hear the sound of? Right, like Hana. So we'll have a few more opportunities to try really specific things with this niggun as we encounter different interpretations of this story in our text. So.
But before we do that, you may have noticed a few words in this niggun that are not from the biblical text that you encountered in your Talmud classes and in the text that we just read from Shmuel. So we're going to read this text from your Shalmei Brachot, and I'm just going to offer a kavanah that you sort of listen in this text for what it's, how is it reading Chana's tefillah, and in terms of what it might say about her relationship to God in that moment, and in terms of what it might mean for us to be looking to her for understanding and unpacking that relationship.
Re'ei kama hu gavoha me'olamo. Ve'adam nichnas le'beit ha'knesset. Ve'omeid acharei ha'amud. Mipalel. Ve'lach isha. Ve'akadosh baruch hu ma'azin et tfilato. Shne'emar. Ve'chana hi medaber aliba. Rak sifateha na'ot v'kolah. Lo'yishama.
This paragraph is saying that we can learn from Hannah's silence, right, and the fact that God responds to that silent prayer, that no matter how loud we pray, God can and will be responsive to that prayer. So then what Shira's asking, and I feel like we should actually do names as we're going. I feel like I'm going to ask folks as you share the first time, if you can share your name. But Shira was wondering, what about this word ha'ezin, right? This word that means to listen, to hear, but it's not the same as like shama, right? Which is a very common way of saying listen. Why? What's this ha'ezin doing? I don't know if you have an instinct about that.
I think to me it may be like that. It gave me some instinct of like God, like not just like it's not just like, oh, isn't God amazing? God has the ability to like hear all kinds of things. Like God actually like is listening to you.
Is that the difference between has even?
Well, something I was just thinking about is what's the shoresh of ha'ezin? It's ozen, right? And I think one of the things that I think makes the telling of Hana's story so expressive is that it has all of these body parts, right? It's like really talking about what she's doing with each of her body parts, right? Himadamberet alimba, raksvatehanaot, right? So she's speaking on her, right, to her heart, and just her lips are moving, right? And her kol is not being heard. And then, so let's keep going in this text. That's a really good setup for the second paragraph, so you can keep going.
Tvilala ani ki yatov lifnei Hashem yishboch sicho. Ka adam Mashiach ba'ozen
Messiah.
Messiah. Ba'ozen chaviro v'hu shemei. V'chi yesh lecha Eloha karov mizav shehu karov levirotav kapet le'ozen.
So what's the second paragraph saying?
I think especially taken together, I don't know that this is just the second paragraph, but I was thinking about from the comment on the Sharash being ozen, like, Chana isn't actually audible to humans. She's only like your ear would not be helpful. She's not making any noise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's even quieter than this person whispering behind the pillars of the synagogue. And yet God is able to not just listen to her, respond to her, but to physically hear.
Yeah.
There's this like very physical closeness of like God is like directly in front of her mouth.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's like what this last line is saying, right? And that's the part quoted in the Nikun, right? Karov levirotav kipet laozen. Right. Again, for me, this was so evocative of like a mouth to an ear. Right, it's like you're whispering in your, you know, you're just like turning to the person next to you and whispering in their ear, and that's how close God is to people who are praying.
There's also something so intentional about the image of a mouth to an ear, right? That that one or both of you have to make the choice to come close, to have it. Or on the other hand, I was just thinking about this right now, is that on the one hand, it implies a real intentionality of closeness between the two beings, the being with the mouth and the being with the ear. On the other hand, there's also this image of like, my mouth and my ear are always attached to the same face, and you actually can't escape one another. So there's, on the flip side, there's this idea that perhaps like the closeness of this prayer between the person and God is just, it's always attached, like the mouth and the ear to the face.
So this source D here is the source for a lot of actually halachic material around how do you daven the Amidah. We learn this from Hana, from this source.
Could it be that one should raise one's voice and pray? No, it is explicit regarding Hana. Hana was speaking on her heart. Could it be that one should think only in one's heart? No, scripture teaches only her lips moved. How so? One should move one's lips.
What do you make of this source?
I'm going to say something really controversial, because I think this is a beautiful concept, but I don't like it as a rule of being the only way to pray.
Yeah.
I think, I was thinking about Rabbi Avi's lecture, and talking about like the power of a public prayer that is loud and designed to get attention, and also the power of the things that we might not yet have the words to express, and how that might be a wordless prayer within the heart. And I think, like, to me, both of those do feel like they could be types of prayer that have appropriate places. Maybe not necessarily, like, the type of formal prayer that we're talking about when we talk about the Amidah. But it's interesting, because I feel like the story of Hana often gets used, at least in the circles I was growing up in. See, there's no wrong way to pray.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like it's being very much used here.
being a little legislated, yeah.
To, like, codify something when part of the whole point is she is not in this story, she is not praying like the way she was taught and told to pray.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, it's interesting to me.
Right, and I think that when Shira, you said that this text is like building on the previous one, to me they seem like in tension a little bit with each other. For what? For the reason that you were saying, because, and this is just maybe how I was reading it. I think you could read the first Yerushalmi text the way that you were, but I sort of saw the first Yerushalmi text as being more about like the person who's just like shy or just like wants to be more private and just whispering behind the pillar. Whereas the second text is like, no, this is how we daven the Amida, right? Which to me feels like two different statements, right? About how to understand what Hannah's doing as a model, right? Is Hannah's modeling about like how God will receive even the most quiet of tefillot, which is how I understood that first text, or is Hannah a model of like, that worked, so we should do that all the time, right? Which I think feels a little bit different to me.
I love this idea that makes it big about legibility. I wonder why, if we feel something so strongly, why shouldn't we give it a lot of volume to deliver it? And I wonder if anyone has insights from when we were singing, if there was something different about the quietness that had different intensity. Yeah, and like, yeah, doesn't it seem that if you're loud, it'll naturally have more intensity, and then you'll feel it more, and then God will feel it more? And so why be silent? It's like, seems so many people could just do the Amidah and actually not pray with their heart. And that being loud could be a great way to hold each other to being loud and feeling it.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we should try singing. I mean, your question of does intensity in song come out just with volume, or are there other ways to like play with that? What I'd like to do is try, and then maybe we'll do some chavruta, is just thinking a little bit about the way that this source is asking us to think about the prayer. If we can try to do it quietly but with intensity, and also I keep being called to this aliba on one's heart. And I want, before we even start singing it, could we kind of get the pulse of this niggun into our heart so we can go like, doom, 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 doom. Don't speed up. We're just going to hum it. And as you do that, you should be able to actually feel, just with the humming, the vibrations coming from your chest into your hands as you do this. And so even though the volume will be quiet, try to notice the intensity of it being more present in your being because of the vibrations. This sort of like this like breaking and this rebuilding that comes from the breaking, I'd like us to sing it, and then this time we're we're going to think a little bit about what are the opportunities for play in the melody that you hear, that you can sort of exit the boundaries of the specific melody. Do you hear other notes that are possible, even if they don't sound good or they don't work with what the person next to you is doing? What are the other kind of ways you can like break away a little bit from the boundaries of the niggin, and what are the opportunities that come from that breaking? And then your point about like rebuilding, how do you then, if you've broken away from the core melody, can you find your way back to where everyone else is? So I feel just now like part of what happened in that breaking was that something new was actually being created in that moment, which feels connective to what we just learned. So I think we'll finish in song. We're going to start by I think singing the niggin the way I'm sort of feeling called to when I read this source, like kind of not just loud, but this word like wide, like with like a like an expansiveness in hearing the possibilities of the song, which does include some of what we studied earlier, and it also includes like the quiet, right? So sort of expansiveness and power. And then we'll just sing it for a while and kind of finish hearing all the different ways that we've understood this niggin. And we'll go in between niggin and text. And you can always feel free to go back to the niggin if the text isn't serving you, or vice versa.
Deep below.
medaber et aliba, accept my death.